How do you maintain the systems of a developed or semi-developed or whatever country in those situations? That's a real tough one. And I don't think we've really come to terms with that yet. People are thinking about it, but I think that's going to be, unfortunately, something we're going to be dealing with in a lot of places. And it's almost the reverse. You'll be dealing with large scale movements of people to other places. And how do you actually accommodate them?
Welcome to another episode of the Crisis Lab podcast. I'm Kyle, your host, and today we're discussing the pressing issue of climate-induced relocation. And to do so, we're glad to have Mr. Patrick Marchman, a leading figure in climate adaptation, resilience, and hazard mitigation planning, as our guest today. Patrick, who currently serves as principal at KM Sustainability, has an impressive career spanning nearly two decades. He has worked extensively in both the public and private sectors, including the U.S. government, and has been a leader in the emerging areas of climate-induced relocation. So in this episode, we will shed light on the realities of climate migration and managed retreat from community level to global perspectives, and we'll delve into the significant implications of climate-induced relocation. So we're going to discuss its complexity, the unique responses at the various levels of our governments and communities. We'll also explore how climate change is not just an environmental issue, but a humanitarian one, forcing people to relocate and triggering a cascade of security concerns and geopolitical tensions and the political repercussions of making these tough decisions. So with Patrick's wealth of on-the-ground experience and insights, we aim to deepen our understanding of these pressing issues and explore adaptation strategies. So Patrick, it's a pleasure to have you with us today. Thanks for coming and joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
As we start this conversation and unpack this idea around this topic, one of the things that I wanted to reach out to you about and have a conversation around was, really, can you describe the current global situation in terms of climate-induced relocation, and then what are the key trends and challenges that we're seeing today? I think that might be good to just get us started in the conversation.
Yeah. So short answer is it's hard to tell. There's a lot of different estimates and such. They range pretty wildly from the International Organization of Migration to academic studies and such. But one thing that can be said is that it is happening, and it is accelerating in many areas. It ranges from movements within census tracts in the United States, which have been pretty now academically documented, to larger scale movements between countries, between continents even. And there's no real reason to expect that it's going to slow down anytime soon. In fact, it's likely to continue to become a factor and starting intruding into lots of other aspects of politics and society.
Now, I've seen, and I think a lot of people have seen, the migration issues in terms of international borders and boundaries and that perspective, but you mentioned census tracts. Can you explore that a little bit more about what you're seeing or what the sort of data is pointing to?
Sure. This is speaking specifically within the United States. So climate-induced relocation includes a lot of things, from the scale of people, mass migrations between countries, down to potentially someone who's had their house relocated from one side of the street to another. There's been a lot of debate, as I mentioned before, about how exactly to classify it and when is it starting. So it's made it difficult. But we are starting to see at the census tract level, which is a basic, it's even smaller than, say, a zip code, the U.S. postal code system. It's a very small geographic space, about as fine-grained as you can really get with a lot of the voluminous census data out there. It can go almost to the level of neighborhoods in some places. So you're starting to see detectable movement away from census tracts that are directly on the shore in several cities, such as Miami and places like that. Now, that seems a little counterintuitive because you can look at, so prices for condos are going up in certain places, but in a lot of places that aren't, a lot of, say, working-class neighborhoods and such, or even not, you're starting to see a reduction in the increase of housing prices that is measurable compared to more inland areas. You're also seeing people, it's been debated as to how people are going to move. There's the general idea that someone's going to pick up and move maybe 1,000 miles, but that's not really how migration tends to work. In its early stages, migration tends to work within communities, within family networks, people wanting to stay as close to a familiar area as possible. What you're starting to see is exactly what you'd think you'd see in that, given that those conditions. You're seeing that certain census tracts are, that there's a detectable movement between census tracts away from those that are most vulnerable to, say, storm surges and such, to places that are maybe slightly higher, slightly less vulnerable. Now, this is not where it's going to end. This is really the first step. you're starting to see a little bit. But one of the important things about this is that this has been documented in papers by researchers at the First Street Foundation. This is as kick the tires publishing papers as you can get. We're starting to see real evidence. Beyond that, you're seeing a little bit more effort. You're starting to see hints that there might be the beginnings of some broader trends, say from Miami to Orlando as an example, Orlando being much more inland than, say, Miami. You're seeing also one paper I saw recently has been some hints that in Colorado and Nevada, there have been hints that some companies are making decisions about which offices, whether to open or expand existing offices or to open new offices, partially based on heat projections. And the difference is potentially they may be slightly less likely to go in areas with more extreme heat than other areas. Again, this is new. This is very early on. And there's a galaxy of studies that can be done. But these studies are indicative that this is not really alarmism. There is something materially happening right now and that you can, by sort of academic standards, can be measured.
That makes me think to a certain extent that, and I'd be curious to see if you've seen any studies on this, but I can't recall. I think it was maybe just last year or even as recent as this year, discussions around the insurance industry pulling away from more disaster prone areas, leaving the state of California, for example, just because it's not economically viable to sustain their operations in high hazard sort of risk areas. And so they're actually making an economic decision not to do business in certain states. I think Florida was another one, just because hurricanes and with the climate security situation happening and the climate change situation happening, more frequent, more intense, more powerful storms, obviously they're making a economic decision there. From these studies and the papers that you've read, are they overlaying part of that initial findings of sort of relocation and overlaying the economic issues as well with that? Because we're seeing it, and where my head goes when we talk about this is my head goes to the economic aspect of why people are relocating. But you're seeing an industry, which I think is also surprising. And exactly to your point about our offices or corporations making decisions based on the location and, like you said, heat mapping of a location and the climate that office might be in and the additional costs that go with that. So I'm wondering how those sort of overlay or how those correlate to each other, if there's any sort of study on that as well.
That's a great question. And the answer is, I'm not sure those overlays have really started happening yet. Again, these are like a lot of this is going to be. Is still very discrete areas and such. I will say that people are thinking about it. They're thinking about it a lot. The economic development piece, I think, is frankly a new frontier of climate adaptation. Because one of the things we're talking about this is somewhat related to what you just mentioned. If you actually look in the United States especially, but other places to some degree as well, property taxes are a major way the communities operate. And so when you talk about, say, a managed retreat from a shoreline or of a street or of a neighborhood, you're not just moving people or buildings or anything. You're actually reducing a tax base. And that makes a lot of communities very reluctant to engage in such. It adds a lot of difficulty. Now, that is not quite as severe in places with different tax regimes, but even these kind of issues are there. And I want to go, so I haven't really seen that yet, but I'm sure that this is coming. I do want to go back to what you mentioned about insurance, because this is not just the U.S. phenomenon. This is a global phenomenon. I know for a fact this happened in Australia, some other places like that. What's in the news as a novelty, it's still going on. The news has moved on, but the insurance companies are still doing what they're doing, and they're starting to boost rates in places that you wouldn't think, because, again, the increasing frequency of natural hazards and such. Maybe it's not even by the shoreline, but in a place where there are teams of modelers and such, and they're looking at the increasing frequencies of tornadoes. They're going to have another reason to do this. And it's not really, and I'll depart from some opinions on this. It's not really solely a matter of, say, corporate greed. It's a matter of, frankly, the bean counters are looking at their balance sheets. Insurers are not charities. The entire foundation of insurance is that if people are going to pay in a little bit, and then they'll be able to pay out in case something happens. But that frequency will not be enough to bankrupt the whole pot. And so the whole point of insurance is make sure you're going to have balanced those things out. And a lot of insurers, and this is talking about the insurers themselves, but the reinsurers that insure the insurers, people like Munich Re, Swiss Re, places like this, are looking at these calculations, and it really doesn't balance out. So, for instance, I just got finished reading The Great Deluge, which was Douglas Brinkley's History of Hurricane Katrina. It's really interesting. It really underlined a lot of Katrina had a massive strain on the insurance industry just by its nature. If projections are correct, as hurricanes get more frequent, every year you roll the dice. And if you roll the dice, say a hurricane that goes smack into a major city and maybe one or two hurricanes in a row, that's going to put the entire global insurance industry under a lot of strain. It's increasingly globalized, and it's not really just an issue of the damage. Insurance is the invisible infrastructure that really makes the modern world work. Everything we do is based on this sort of thing. So again, this is where you get into money and the finance. My brain has never been really attuned to this as much as it should be, but I try to really learn a lot more about this because this is the real indicator. We can look out our windows and we can see storms and we can rationalize statistics and such like that. But the insurers, I think, are probably going to be the first real contact that most ordinary people in the developed world at least have with climate change.
I'm glad you mentioned the tax base issue because I was actually at an event last week and I was talking with some colleagues of mine from the EU and we were talking about the conflict in Ukraine and the war in Ukraine. And how we were discussing exactly the same thing of what you mentioned, but within the context of relocation of populations and internally displaced persons out of communities that are closer towards the front line in Ukraine, because ultimately, how do you manage to keep the fire service, police service, court systems alive when you lose the tax base and you lose 26% of your population? And that's an extreme amount of tax base and tax revenue that you lose as a city, and how do you maintain municipal services with degrading tax base? And that's where I think, even though that's a highly accelerated rate that's happening in Ukraine, you could draw somewhat of a parallel to the relocation of a population in a city and the slowly just death by a thousand cuts of sort of a city budget, and how you just slowly degrade services and then people end up leaving anyway because the environment is no longer fitting.
Very much. That is precisely the scenario I think that has kept me up at night before and that keeps a lot of people in the adaptation field up increasingly, because the disasters are, of course, noteworthy. We all have to prepare for them. We all mobilize as countries and as human beings. We mobilize for those. And it's easy to do that. The slow, that slow grind, grinding down of systems, though, is much harder to mobilize against. And you've seen this in many other contexts. It's not really a hypothetical thing. It has happened. Due to other things. It has happened, as you just mentioned, in Ukraine. It is happening. How do you maintain the systems of a developed or semi-developed or whatever country in those situations? That's a real tough one. And I don't think we've really come to terms with that yet. People are thinking about it, but I think that's going to be, unfortunately, something we're going to be dealing with in a lot of places. And it's almost the reverse. You'll be dealing with large-scale movements of people to other places, and how do you actually accommodate them? Because I think that can be, again, a lot of places would love to have that problem. And in the state of Michigan, well, it would be a balance, a good thing. But again, you're going to have to, how do you build the infrastructure for them? How do you really integrate them socially and such? That, again, is something that if you don't have that, you can see Canada as a country right now is a great example. Canada has really turned on the immigration spigot. Everyone come to Canada. Let's do it. But right now, housing prices are just skyrocketing everywhere. You hear a lot of, and you actually look in terms of popular opinion, it is getting very negative because, yes, you brought the people in, but you didn't give the infrastructure for them. And you haven't really built out the economy to be ready. So again, it's going to be a balancing act. And it's something that it's going to require a lot of really deep thinking and planning to accommodate what's happening for not only this year, but for the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years down the line, because this is only going to accelerate.
Hey there, it's Kyle again. And just a quick note and a pause in our show for just a second. Did you know that most of our guests on the Crisis Lab podcast have courses inside of Crisis Lab? Many of our guests are actually instructors on our own platform. So if you're finding value in these conversations or they pique your interest and you want to dive deeper into the topics that we're talking about, just head over to crisislab.io for more information. Our courses, webinars, and resources are all designed to equip professionals just like you with the knowledge needed to navigate complex and changing environments. And we recognize that your time matters, so everything we do is accredited. So don't forget to subscribe to and join our community of over 17,000 professionals who follow Crisis Lab and are committed to enhancing preparedness and their strategic thinking. Because at Crisis Lab, we believe in empowering you with a cross-domain knowledge and learning blended with international perspectives, ultimately making you better every single day. Now let's get back to the show. At Crisis Lab, we tend to focus on not only just preparing and working through a crisis, but then also post a major national crisis and getting into post-conflict space. And then how do we stabilize societies and rebuild. And it does make me think, when I think about the insurance, and then I want to touch on the points that you just raised, have discussions in terms of wartime insurance and what that means for nations. If you're going to go fight a war, and insurance companies like in the Black Sea will not insure vessels to carry food that is much needed for Africa, for example, then you have to have a nationally sponsored insurance program. So the nation has to back the insurance that's required. And so then you, if again, that's an extreme situation, but it's a wartime insurance program. And then if you look at a situation like California, where commercial entities are making a decision not to do business in your state, there's, and the people who are listening, you can Google this and see all the exact details. But I think California was exploring the idea of state-funded insurance programs. But then you have to think, okay, you know, we take one extreme situation of wartime insurance, which is ideally more temporary in nature, right, with possibly some international support. And then you get into a static, sustained, state-sponsored insurance program, which will just be hit by multiple disasters recurring over and over again. To me, doesn't really sound very sustainable, especially across this landscape of a decreasing tax base, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be something that I think is just on the surface appears to be a solution. But as you're saying, as you used an example of Canada, on the surface, this appears to be the direction, the solution that we're going with. But I don't think all that sort of infrastructure and the discussions about the adaptation that's needed for this changing environment has really taken place. Like, it was these ideas were, or well, we'll just put in this solution and we'll state sponsor the insurance. But I don't think you'll have 3 or 4, 10 fires and some other sort of climate-related disasters, and then it's going to be bankrupt at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're touching on something really important, sort of state-sponsored insurance. So it's not just California. Florida has, a lot of these states have these programs, and they're not necessarily bad things. What is bad is when they're like, they create the program and they just do run it as it's been run before, as a big version of what has not worked well before. So it's basically kicking the can down the road. So you could, and potentially you might, maybe should have a state-sponsored insurance program, but it has to be really conceptualized quite differently than we've been doing it. The great example that comes into my mind is the American NFIP, the National Flood Insurance Program. And that, over decades, says even though it's a really small percentage of Americans that have insurance, flood insurance has really created a moral hazard in lots of places. It's really encouraged the building of homes in places where they shouldn't be built. And so you have to really think about that. And again, with things, when you're talking about migration and such, migration, all these things can be very good things. If done well, it can be absolutely the cure that everyone thinks it is, which you have to be willing to deal with it in a holistic manner, in a creative manner. Otherwise, just doing something politically expedient is going to lead to, it's going to generally lead to bad outcomes. It's just that it doesn't really do the job. And you know, unfortunately, you'd mentioned that decreasing tax base. You're also, when you have the curves of a decreasing tax base, increasing disasters, you put those together, you're gonna get a crunch. The crunch will be felt and it will be expressed eventually politically.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's draw upon that discussion. Let's take a look at the concept of managed retreat. So can you explain a little bit about the managed retreat and how that fits into this broader narrative of climate migration that we're talking about?
Certainly. A managed retreat is generally, but maybe the smaller scale end of it, which is basically retreat from, and it's usually used in terms of sea level rise, but it could also be from wildfire, the one urban interface and such like that. But basically, retreat from areas that are becoming increasingly vulnerable due to the impacts of climate change. So managed retreat is a concept you're seeing all over the world. I would say there's a lot of, depending on the property regimes of certain nations, it's easier to do than in other places. But even the easiest places, legally, there's still a lot of social ramifications. You're seeing, you know, retreat. So there's national programs. In New Zealand is a national plan that explicitly mentions this. You're seeing a lot of states in the United States are starting to do this. New York State is just, I think, closed an RFP to help develop like an official retreat program. You're seeing this in lots of places. People do it in many different ways, but it's really, I would say it's generally at the community or the highest regional level, the real kind of reconfiguring what communities, cities, regions look like vis-a-vis their natural environment.
So if we are reconsidering what our cities look like, and we are thinking again about how we design even just this urban wildland interface and everything that goes along with it, what are some of the unique challenges then if we are going through this thought process and looking at how we can move populations or more communities, and especially if they get into a
When I hear you talking about it, I just immediately think, oh man, this is going to be like the city hall meeting and people are trying to convey an idea of how we need to move. And just the other sort of shock and horror of that conversation. But what happens, there's two sides of that. So how are communities looking at this from a negotiation point of view, public education, slower development lane, versus those that are forced to relocate due to the changing climate?
That's an excellent question. The answer is it's a mess. It's honestly a mess.
Either way.
Everything does this, everywhere is thinking about this differently. So I'd say, again, in the United States, there is no national managed street program. The closest things that might come to it, you might see some state level ideas are starting to be there, but you might see regional, local buyouts through FEMA or through some other agency. But again, they've very rarely talked to each other. They're very rarely coordinated in any kind of context. Some of the major challenges, I would say, is we've mentioned this before, but how do you conduct a retreat that does not adversely impact not just the tax base, but say the economic capacity or in the social structure of an area? A lot of times we've had one of the major problems in more individualistic societies, and this is actually, I just have an interesting thought about this, has been we have like neighborhoods, a lot of like more disadvantaged populations that have lived in neighborhoods, and while you have the social fabric. And so when you come along and give a check for $250,000, you can do that. You can actually get, that's fair compensation. Here are the issues. Number one, how much is that going to mean in a community, in a metropolitan area where most of the homes are like $500,000? It's not going to mean very much. Where are they going to go with that? The other thing is people generally will scatter because you don't really purchase homes en masse. So it's almost a guaranteed way to scatter communities. There's a great example, and this whole idea is a big example. I'm thinking in terms of in the province of Newfoundland, there was the outboard relocation. There are a lot of villages that were not served by roads and such or services. And so from the 1950s onwards, there was a process of sort of relocation of these outboards, as they were called. And a lot of times the government would pay and pretty much move entire villages or even buildings, put them on a boat and send them somewhere. Now, some of the outcomes were, there's a lot of stories about it, local songs and such about it. But one of the interesting things is up until maybe the 80s or 90s, there was generally almost a more of a social kind of quote unquote big government program where people were paid and you get a bunch of people and you stick them in a place. After around the 1990s, 2000, it became measurably more individualistic. And so some of the earlier outcomes where you had like communities in some ways keeping the social fabric a little bit started really going away. And so you started seeing worse outcomes with the more kind of the choice-based architecture. Now, that's something inherent. When you talk about choice in general, again, in the United States at least, you can't, unless an entity basically invokes eminent domain, they can't really come and just force you out. They give you a lot of incentives, but they can't really do that. So that's a really tough way. Now, you can make the choices harder. And so at some point, for instance, people are starting to think about what happens when that one home refuses to sell. You've seen it. There's a famous picture in China, like this home, they literally is on a giant, like a tiny piece of land, and they dug all the way around it because the homeowner will refuse. You've seen this in other places. There was a movie up, a Disney movie, that started out like that. And they'll make the choice harder by starting to have to continue services, to continue utilities, to holdouts and such. And then there's, again, the political backlash. You mentioned sort of those city hall meetings. I can tell you, I've heard a lot of backlash in my time just from the idea of anything hinting around that. State of California, up and down this coastline, that's one way, at least in the few years ago, is an easy way to get yourself not reelected as a mayor to mention this. And so it's incredibly tricky. It's incredibly hard. I will say success stories I've seen. One I think about is in Australia. And I actually know the gentleman who did it, Jamie Simmons. He's a great guy. And he helped. There was a series of floods in a really small town in Queensland. And basically, they almost threw out the rule book in some ways and said, okay, we got to do something. He got carte blanche to come up with a new area. They bought a plot of land. They almost came up with like almost a lottery system to make sure everyone felt they were being fairly treated and compensated. People didn't have to move if they wanted to. But again, they made it in such an inclusive sort of way and not like inclusive maybe in the way we think about it now. But it's a way of everyone participate in such that most everybody did. They And they made it happen really fast. And a lot of that, he's in demand like all over Australia, New Zealand for that. That's one model. Again, you have to, there has to be a sense of fairness. There has to be a sense of buy-in. It has to be a sense of you're not, it's not just me being asked to sacrifice. And that, again, keep going back to politics, because this is almost a universal thing, no matter what, even in authoritarian countries, there is political opinion. And when people feel like there's a fair shake, they generally respond better. When they don't feel like that they're getting treated fairly, that they don't. And this can be even like really tough decisions. I think people are more mature than they give them credit. People give them credit for sometimes. They get it, but they also get when they're being screwed.
Yes, very true. And so when we are looking at this and we're looking at this topic, and you said that at state level, there's some at least inklings of there's some discussions happening, but nationally really no sort of managed retreat type of policies really in development. What about the international level? Are we seeing anything being published internationally from the various international organizations that are focused on this as well, or is it still fairly new?
Still fairly new. I know that there's a network in Europe, the Hugo Observatory, which has several universities and such. They do a lot of research. I mean, the International Organization for Migration is doing a lot of like climate migration. They're thinking about this a lot. And the UN level, UN is, it's really fulfilling its function as like the world's largest NGO. It's doing very well in that. There's a lot of like promotion. There's a lot of discussion. Now, in terms of coordination, that's tricky. I know there have been some initiatives and such trying to like certain treaties and hints about it, but there's nothing of a scale that's going to even come close. Nothing. And I think that's going to be the next frontier about how exactly is there a way to really think on a maybe an international level. The EU might have a bit of an advantage, but the EU itself is a quasi-national entity. So it's, but I talk about beyond the bounds of it. Like, how do you work directly with these countries? Because again, we'll go back to the US because it's what I'm most familiar with. Right now, a lot of the dynamics with the migration into the US has been not from Mexico, it's from Central America. And it's been almost like places like Venezuela or places. There's been, the way the US has handled this has been almost like a largely trying to put some pressure on Mexico itself and saying, okay, that'll be our first line of defense. And there's not a lot of discussion to say how to get people from having to leave the Guatemalan highlands, which they're having to leave because of climate change and such, but how do you make maybe, are there going to be opportunities in Guatemala or Honduras to give them different ways of life, help them, ease them into something that's not quite climate sensitive? Or if they get to Mexico, how do you figure out there's maybe some ways to integrate them a little bit more into that system? Or if they finally do get to the U.S., what exactly how do you go about this rather than again, it's an incredibly sensitive political football. But I know for a fact people discuss this and think about it. But in terms of the political will, it's just incredibly sensitive. Think about if you're the government of Guatemala or Honduras and you're having to admit just how bad things are and likely going to get. Think if you're whatever government level, it's incredibly tough and sensitive. So that's a long answer to a short question, which is not a whole lot, but again, they better start thinking about it.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Because some of these nations that are highly impacted can be relatively small populations.
Yes.
And I say that from a US perspective, how many millions of people do you have in New York City? What was it, 11 million or something like that? But and how many millions of people in sort of San Francisco, LA area? These are smaller sized countries, right? These are, and sometimes small to medium sized countries in many different ways. A lot of the countries that we work with in around the world are tens of millions, not hundreds of millions like the United States. And so when you start having a sort of a mass migration in that way, I can only imagine you're sitting there thinking, especially coming from smaller cities, we just turn into a ghost town. Right. Mm-hmm. And that your entire population leaves, then what are you supposed to do? And then you're essentially looking at worst case scenario, turning into a failed state at some point.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So I another area I'm somewhat familiar with is the Pacific. So a lot of Pacific Islands, you just mentioned the population, say New York, San Francisco, the population of the Marshall Islands, from what I understand, is between 70,000 and 100,000 people at most. And for what I heard from a reputable source last summer, that the majority of Marshallese population at this point is probably in the United States, because there's a certain relationship that allows Marshallese and Micronesians and people from Palau to live and work really in the United States. That's a sort of example. This is a microscopic drop in the bucket. Just to give you a perspective, I live outside of a metropolitan area in Ohio that has 600,000 people in it. And that the Marshallese population, its highest estimate, is 1/6 of that. So it's a there's a lot of really small areas. And the Marshall Islands specifically has been very forward thinking because they've had to be. They put out a climate adaptation plan, which is forward thinking to the point where there's contemplation of what happens if virtually is no country. Because the Marshall Islands is largely on low atolls. There's, I think, two rock islands in the whole country. And that will not support a country. And so at some point, you're going to have to start looking legally. Talking about a failed state, I almost was a wonder. I think there's other countries that have contemplated this in the Pacific. What happens if you just roll up a country? How do you legally do that? It's a serious question. And then you look at what does it mean to have countries without how much effective territory? What can they do? Again, this gets really speculative, but it also is a concern. And going a little less speculative, when you're looking at not only the combined birth rates, around the world, birth rates are declining anyway. And so if you're looking at this sort of thing, sooner than people think, there's going to be a lot of countries that are going to be having issues because of the models, again, we've been using for 100 years, are really based on steady growth. And so you add that plus the climate issue, plus people maybe potentially leaving. Yeah, I think failed state is not an exaggeration that I think some places will be looking at. And that itself will give rise to more instability. So that becomes a security issue. Again, it's a tricky thing. It's like you're looking at the future and you're asking policymakers, oh, there's a whole other set of dice you have to roll. And just try to, here's a whole other massive thing that's only going to have to roll the dice almost every year over and over to see what's going to happen. But that is the situation we're in.
Yeah, and it sounds dire. It's not exactly the most sort of positive thing that we're talking about. But let's take a sort of last question I got for you. So if we look into the future and we envision this evolution of climate-induced relocation, and what are the sort of scenarios or trends that we should be aware of, at least on the short to medium term, so that if you are a city manager, if you are working at a state level or federal level, what are some of the things that you should have on your radar?
Number one is going to be insurance and finance. So I mean, it's not just insurance. We discuss that a lot. Finance in terms of the municipal bond markets, that's going to be trickier in certain places. I have knowledge in some cities that the questions are starting to be asked several years ago, like cities that are very low-level cities in the U.S. Starting to look at sort of those sort of flows, the money that really keeps things going. I think being ready for cities that may be in more temperate climes or more like away from a lot of these hazards, growth might become an issue. Be ready for growth. Be ready for sustainable growth. This can actually be a real positive for a lot of these communities. Again, it's tough, really tough to estimate this, but get ready. Eventually, I mean, schools, utility systems, housing and such, and also give people economic opportunities. One example I always like to think about is we all know about the stories of people after the fall of the Soviet Union, they migrate to the U.S. and you have businesses who are driving cabs and such. And that was, the city of Chicago did a really interesting program a while back, which was a kind of accelerated program to get migrants to the city of Chicago to get their credentials recognized in the U.S. So say an engineer, make sure they can get their PE in a much quicker fashion than rather. And that's one stroke. You know, reduce the wasted potential. You get people like producing much more economically than they would have. Things like that. Be looking ways to really, how would you integrate migrants in a way that, you know, is going to be largely be a positive thing. And I think that's one of the, you know, when you convince people that people are going to be able to really pull their weight, then that kind of helps mitigate sort of future resentments against newcomers. I think the last thing, again, I'll say, so I'm saying this is positive. This will all be really positive. The one thing is, though, I'd say, and I know this is tough for city managers, a lot of the work I do these days actually has been almost on a municipal level working with this. I see what they're trying to do, but they really do need to keep their eyes not just focused on what's immediate in front of them. Keep their eyes on a national level. Keep it on an international level. Keep it on the weather, on the climate, because things are moving. They're moving fast, and we are already at the impacts of climate change we're experiencing right now are what was originally projected 20 years ago to happen maybe in 2040. So we're like 15, 20 years ahead of schedule, even with lower emissions than people had thought. So that is a sobering idea. So again, build networks with each other, reach out to other cities, keep your eye on what's going on in the world outside, and be ready to respond to the crisis and be able to grab the opportunity. Because frankly, there will be a lot of both, and being observant and being prepared will allow you to maximize the opportunity and maybe minimize the negative impacts.
I think all of that was great, and it's a great time to close on that note and great point to end the show with. So, Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today on the Crisis Lab podcast. Really appreciate it, and the discussion and the insights you're sharing with the rest of us.
No problem. Glad to be here.
So that's all the time we have for today. Again, a huge thanks to our guest, Mr. Patrick Marchman, for sharing his knowledge and experience as we discuss the emerging subject of climate-induced relocation. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to the Crisis Lab podcast. We hope that today's episode has provided you with new insights and perspectives to better navigate the challenges of your field and in the future. Remember, each episode is a step towards mastering the complexities of crisis management, and we're here to share the knowledge and support you along the way. Again, if you're not subscribed, go ahead and head over to your preferred platform. We prefer LinkedIn ourselves. Hit subscribe and keep up to date with our latest episodes. For more resources and become part of the 17,000 professionals following Crisis Lab, head over to crisislab.io and make sure you follow us on social media, such as LinkedIn and YouTube. And lastly, have you heard about our All Access Pass? It's the opportunity to lock in your pricing for 2024. You'll get 20 accredited courses released during this year, along with at least 10 CEUs and a NATO certificate if you attend the NATO Crisis Management and Disaster Response course. So lock in your costs now, because they're going to go up every single year. Until next time, stay prepared, stay resilient, and let's continue to make a difference together. Thanks for listening.